Laura Odell, and I'm the host of Write Your Story, Heal Your Life, which encompasses many subjects and in writing many genres. And I'm really honored today that I get to interview Donna Stonan, who's the author of her latest book, The Thriver's Edge, 7 Keys to Transform the Way You Live, Love, and Lead. Is a published book, and you have Jack Canfield and a few other great people who actually write and comment and give you great reviews on your book. And before we started the camera and rolling, I was talking about putting the summit together and how amazing it's been, and also seeing how I got overwhelmed. And I've been listening to some of your previous interviews on overwhelm and what happened to you in your career and how you've jumped forward. I'd like to say jump forward, but actually come up with this wonderful way to live, to thrive. So I'd love it if you would address more on the subject. And I also would like to say that we're both graduates of a wonderful college, Californian Institute of Integral Studies.
Yes, we are. A fellow alumni.
A fellow alumni. Yes. Except you have your PhD. I haven't quite got to my PhD, but I did my master's, which is a pretty great feat for me.
Yes, I attended CIS for, I think, a total of 9 years between my master's and my PhD, so I could probably have a beach house now. For all the money I spent, but it was money well worth spending. So I learned a lot. It was a great, great education.
Yes, well, I think there's that famous quote, which is, in any situation, even if you're imprisoned, everything can be taken away from you, but your education can never be taken away.
Your education and your attitude.
Absolutely. And attitude is such a big part of it.
Yes.
And I believe that you really address that. I haven't actually had time to read your book yet since discovering your work, but it's actually on the top 5 for me to read. And I think I probably would put it top on the number 1 of the top 5 because it really seems a book that you really do need to read if you want to have success in your life. And I'm, from the interviews that I've listened to with you, it's the success in your own personal journey of how to be successful in your self-care.
And I think I look at success, you know, when I talk about thriving, I think of it more as being able to really bloom where we're planted. So success for one person can be very different for success for another person. You know, for some people, it's about climbing a corporate ladder and making a lot of money and getting prestige and job titles and power, et cetera. And for another person, it's about being the best mother you could be or the best friend you could be or the best spouse you could be. So I think that's one place we really get tripped up is defining our own ability to thrive, our own ability to flourish based on this cultural trance that we live in our culture, which says it has to be a certain way, and it doesn't. So it's getting clear about what is it that you really want and how do you want to get there?
Absolutely. I remember, and I'm sure I actually shared it in one of the interviews, but I think it's really important for me to share again. But I remember being at a friend's house once, and on his desk, he had a desk calendar. One of the ones, you know, that have spiritual quotes every day. Mm-hmm. And I read the quote for that day. And the quote was, don't confuse your net worth with your self-worth.
Yes. Very true. Very true.
It's so important, and especially living in developing countries, and I'm sure even countries all over the world, we are so focused in our cultures on making money,
Yes. Yes.
And with that, there's never being satisfied for so many people. It doesn't matter once you've got the new car, a year or two later, you want the brand new car and the bigger model and the bigger house. And it comes to that point of when does it stop? And also, can you remind me of the statistics with the research? What's the percent of people in America that they believe are thriving?
Yes, the latest Gallup statistic puts it at about 54%. So here we are in the wealthiest economy in the world, and we rank 17th in world happiness.
Yeah.
And, I think they're the really alarming statistics. And we're, 46% of people don't believe they're thriving. And 7 out of 10 people aren't engaged at work.
Right.
And I think there's a direct correlation about that. Because I think we sell out often for the money, for the titles, for the things that are more externally focused and driven. And in the process of that, a lot of people end up doing things they don't really like doing.
Right. Right.
It just breeds, it's like a spiral. It just, it really breeds more of the same.
Yes. I was sharing on one of the interviews how I feel really fortunate that pretty much for my whole adult life, I've been able to work for myself, and I've been an artist my whole adult life. So I've been really fortunate. I mean, that means, as you know, when you're self-employed, that there's great things that you can often manage your own time and you're not on someone else's schedule. However, the flip side can also be you don't necessarily know this fixed income, or an income that you're going to get every year or every month, and your retirement, etc. So it's really that trade-off. But really been talking in the interviews on how it is possible to follow your passion. It's possible to make your art and your creativity what you do for a living.
Yes.
So within that, usually when I speak to artists, many artists, not all of them, but many seem fulfilled in their life, that they're doing what makes them happy. And as you said, the statistics on happiness is 17% in America, which is really quite disturbing. As my friend's son told me when he was about 12 or 13, he was doing a research project at school. And they were in the project, they said, if you have a roof over your head, a fridge, and a TV, which actually just might be in a hut, a fridge and a TV, but you're actually in the top 10% of the world, if you have that.
Yeah.
So materialistically, we have so much in the United States, and yet it's not correlating with happiness, materialistically.
Mm-hmm. Very true. It's very true. And one of the things that I talk about in my book that's interesting, I think, kind of what led me to want to do the book, is Maslow's notion of the Jonah complex. And he talks about that we're really as afraid to succeed as we are to fail. And there's different reasons for that. And again, those reasons are all really predicated on what it looks like to others, right? So we spend so much of our time living in reflection to those around us rather than really focusing on what helps us thrive. What is it, how are we grounded to ourselves, to our own spirituality, to our own creativity, in ways that enable us to really make the kind of contributions we want to make. And we get in our own way. So you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't.
Right.
It's that, and I talk about that a lot, and that's certainly when I do my coaching work with people, I often talk about we all have a major sort of default that we go into. We all have a deal, right? And mine is not enoughness. So, and there's so many women I work with and so many that I know. And you're right. It's like whatever you do, it's not enough.
Right.
And so that's been a real journey for me, is learning how to celebrate those accomplishments when they happen and really just sit with them and be with them and enjoy them, as well as just the plain, mundane, everyday life that is such a gift. And when you get really busy and crazy, it's hard to do that. It's really hard to do that.
Yes, it's so true. I thought of a number of things as you were speaking. The one thing I remember my mom always says, you don't miss what you've never had, mm-hmm. which is so true. So when I was growing up, when we didn't have all these things, I didn't miss them because I'd never had them. Mm-hmm. You know, I didn't know what it was really like to have your own bathroom. And it was an adventure to go, you know, we'd go to the public baths and you'd pay like 5p or 10p and they'd run a bath for you, go into your cubicle. And it was one of those huge bathtubs with, you know, clawfoot tub. That's what they call them. And, you know, one thing I know I did miss was not being able, I remember going to the beach with my family and not having money to buy ice creams. But it's really put me in a position now of feeling grateful, of knowing what it is like not to have, mm-hmm. and feeling grateful. And I have a note card with an illustration of piles of dirty dishes by my sink, and it has a quote on it that basically says, if you feel like moaning when you have a pile of dirty dishes, be thankful to the goddess that you've just had a great meal.
Yeah.
Just had food.
That's true. It's really true. You know, it's what we focus on really does expand. And I think a gratitude practice is one of the most critical aspects of thriving. And a lot of the people that I work with, that's one of the things that I, as a coach, because I do executive coaching, you know, as part of my career. And that's such an important piece, because if you lose sight of that, it's another thing that disconnects us from really savoring and enjoying this rich morsel of life that we have every day.
Right. It's, yes.
I know for me, I mean, I spent almost 3 years very ill and not able to work and wondering if I would ever be able to work again and be out in the world. And although it was probably one of the most painful experiences of my life, in many ways it was the most fruitful, because it really helped me see, you know, how I had been spending my time, and that I didn't want that kind of quality of life, because I really didn't have one. I was just going to school, you know, working. I was running two companies, and it was crazy. And it took me, you know, I always say we're either motivated out of inspiration or desperation. And a lot of times it's desperation. And the desperation will drive you to say, I got to do this a different way.
Right. Exactly. And that's one of the things that I love about the coaching program that I'm actually in, the business coaching program that I'm in. And the owner of the company, the main coach, Shanda Sumter, really emphasizes having what she calls flex time, which is free time. Mm-hmm. So her example is she takes off 1 week, I believe it's 1 week every month. Mm-hmm. And it might not be consistently, you know, the Monday to Sunday, but if you add up all the days, and she takes off the whole month of December, etc. And apart from putting together this summit, there's definitely been days where I've had to sort of work through the weekends and work till midnight. But in general, I keep my schedule so that I can really practice a Shabbat, you know, really take Fridays and go through Sundays and have these 4-day weeks, work weeks, and 3 days off. And obviously, there's things that have to be done on those 3 days. You know, there's the laundry to catch up on, etc. But primarily, that Friday and Saturday, I just really try and not push myself, not do the work. Because, as you mentioned, you were very ill, and we haven't discussed what your illness was, but I think for a lot of people, when you're working, you are working 80-hour weeks. Mm-hmm. So you really can get to that complete adrenal fatigue, adrenal burnout. Mm-hmm. And how do you prevent yourself from doing that? And I just went to my friend's daughter's bat mitzvah, and her whole bat mitzvah research project was on Shabbat. And she was talking about how in the scriptures, in the old scripture, if someone did not practice Shabbat and they were working on Shabbat, they would be executed. And you're just, wow. What? You'd be executed?
That'll get your attention.
That would get your attention. And I think it did get people's attention because it was really about why it's so important to rest.
Yes, exactly. It really is. And it's interesting, you know, I think I mentioned to you earlier that too much of a good thing can be a bad thing. And I certainly experienced that when my book came out, because I had been working really hard on it. And then, so I was running, you know, more than full-time coaching practice. And I was on the road doing a book tour, going, you know, from hither to yon. And then in the sort of the middle of that, I went to Texas and moved my mother out here. So I basically had 3 full-time jobs at the same time. And I was not having any joy in my life. I was not having any fun. And I felt like an imposter, because I was going out and doing these talks and then feeling, well, I'm not practicing what I preach. And so that's why I call it the thriver's edge, because it really is an edge. It's an edge that you have to be really conscious about and really choiceful about. And really looking at where do you want to be in your life for you, not for everything around you or what you think the expectations are. And how do you craft that? How do you craft that kind of life?
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had coaching clients that were very successful in their career, and they were driving 2 hours each way to work, and they had little kids, and they made the decision not to do that anymore. And it was the right decision for them.
Right.
So it's really looking at what's your own definition, again, of success and what's important to you.
Yes, and I look back. Thank you for sharing that, because I look back on my life and I think, wow, when I had 2 young children and they're 2 years and 9 months apart, I was running a company, running a record company, running a mail order company, being in a band, and I had 2 young children. I didn't have a nanny. And how did I do that? And I know that I would put the children to bed and go back into the office and work till midnight or 1, because that was the only way I was going to get work done. And I look back and I think, I really don't know how I did that. It was working those hours that people work, and that you mentioned, you know, those 80-hour weeks. I don't know if I was doing 80 hours. I definitely think I was pushing it to the 60 hours. And I reflect and think, I think I could only do that because I was young. You know, I was in my 20s and I had all this energy. And now I don't know, when you were saying that you had two businesses and you were in school, when I was doing my master's at CIS, I was not working. I was on a sabbatical. I mean, I was working doing my master's. And I also wondered when I was in school, I don't know how people I don't know how they do it.
They really
don't. And I think a lot of it is that we're different personalities. And there's also that when we have to do it, we will do it. Just like I did all those things when my kids were young. And maybe I would have been able to do a full-time job and be in school as well. So I'm really impressed that you were doing all those things, working so hard, and yet it did have a physical toll on you.
Yeah, you know, at what cost, right? So I had, at the time, and this was really a turning point in my life. I was working, doing a lot of my work at the time, not full-time, but I was working with a company and working with a woman who's, I share the story in my book, her name was Ellen. And I was helping her run a change management initiative for her company. And she was really in a tough situation because she worked 24/7. She did not take care of herself. She did not have a lot of support in the organization for the kind of work she was trying to do. And she was like the only light in that company, in that darkness, right? So she was doing everything she could do to help turn things around. And I started to notice she didn't look well. And one day we had lunch and I said to her, you know, I remember I wrote on a piece of butcher block paper off the table, almost Dr. Donna RX, take off work for 3 days, leave your phone at home, go to a monastery and rest. And she grabbed the piece of paper and she wadded it up and she threw it back at me. She said, stop worrying about me, I'm fine. And that was a Friday. And that Monday, I got a call from one of her managers who said, I have some really sad news. She said, Ellen passed away on Friday night in a hot tub. She had a stroke. And I was so distressed by that and so upset because she was also my friend. And a couple of months, I was at the time starting to get sick. And a couple of months after she died, I had a dream one night. And she's on this bus dressed like she usually is in this pink wool suit and white stiletto heels and a glass of wine in one hand and a cigarette in the other. And she's screaming at the bus driver, let me off this bus. Not exactly. She was more colorful than that, but let me off this bus right now. And he's like, lady, you can't get off this bus. This is your bus. And she flung the door open and she screamed out to me, Donna, be careful which bus you get on. And that to me was a shift in my life. And I spent that time really looking at myself, looking at my false self, really trying to unpack who I was and what were my gifts and what was I here to do in the world and not do. And I made the commitment at the time, if I ever recover from this, I'm going to do things differently. And that's when I really started my coaching practice in earnest and really, you know, this whole notion about thriving and how do you move from being a victim to a survivor to a thriver? And that's part of the arc, you know, that we go through. Some of us, not all of us, but a lot of us.
Thank you for sharing that story because, well, partly it really is that wake-up call when you hear about something that happened to your friend, that you can really overwork yourself, that our physical selves and bodies really can only take so much stress.
Yes.
And I remember, actually it was at the community college, so I only got my bachelor's at CIS in 2013. So I left school when I was 18, went straight into running my businesses, had my kids young, etc. So I was at the community college for 5 years, and I remember taking a class there, and it was on Native American history and archaeology. And I remember the professor saying that on average with the Native Americans, and he was talking specifically about the tribes in Northern California, including the Miwoks, that the average work day in terms of going out hunting, doing all those things, you know, to actually survive in terms of having enough food, was around 3 to 4 hours a day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the rest of the day doesn't mean that people weren't working in terms of like taking care of children and weaving and preparing food. But how we've gone from 4 hours a day to, mm-hmm. you know, 8 to 16 hours a day. I mean, you know, as a culture, probably Japan would come up quite high in terms of these incredibly long work days that extend when people leave work and continue with their business meetings in the evening, etc. But basically, that it's not natural or normal. I mean, my therapist said the only thing, really the only thing that's normal is the setting on the washing machine. There's no one thing that comes into that. So you said going from the first one, you said, I know it went, it goes from surviving into thriving, but what's
I think that we do live in a culture. I mean, if you look at the news right now, politically, what's going on, we live in a culture that we're in a blame game.
Right, so right.
It's victim, right? It's
right, right.
And I don't want to in any way diminish people that truly are victims of sexual assault or violence or anything like that, because they, I mean, that's absolutely rampant as well. But I think it's the victim mentality that a lot of people can get into easily, the blaming on others. And I think there's an arc where people can move from being, feeling like they're a victim to just feeling like they're a survivor. And I think a lot of people live in that space of just, I'm just surviving. I call it barely getting by. And I'm not even talking about financially. I'm talking about what it feels like in your life. The sense of overwhelm, the sense of my time is not my time. Time manages me. I don't manage my time. To then actually being able to thrive. And I think that that's the journey. You know, not everybody goes through the victim piece, but most people at one point or another in their life, a lot of people anyway, go through the survivor piece, right?
Right.
To get by. And so I've asked the question for many years of my life and lived with the question, what does it take to help you move from being a survivor to being a thriver?
Mm-hmm.
And that's really what the book is about. Because I've come up with, you know, 7 keys that I think really do help us move from just surviving to really being able to thrive and work in life.
And can you share some of those keys with us, with the audience?
Sure.
And I'd like to ask, because I think it's important for everyone to know those, and also if there's people in the audience who we know that there has to be someone and probably many people who are probably doing jobs where they feel burnt out, they're not happy with, they might be in a corporate job, they just want to run their own business, they want to focus on their writing or their art.
Mm-hmm.
And how can people do that? You know, what steps are you recommending from your research?
So do you want me to start with the keys and then move into that question?
That would be fantastic.
So the 7 keys that are in the book are, and it's a Thriver moniker, T-H-R-I-V-E-R, because I need things to help me remember. So,
yeah.
And the first one is trust. And I think that it's really important to, first of all, trust yourself. And to be able to trust, because when you can trust yourself and you can move to that place, it enables you to trust a lot of other people. If you really don't trust yourself, it's unlikely you're going to trust others. So part of the work in trusting is being able to do what I call expanding your circle of trust. You know, at the end of the day, I really do believe 99.9% of us have positive intentions. We don't seek to hurt other people.
Right.
It's not in our DNA to try and hurt other people. We do, but we often do it because we're either not as conscious as we need to be or not as thoughtful as we need to be. But it's not malicious. So, and especially if you've been betrayed, it's really hard to trust. And that, I think, is one of the central pieces. So in the book, in each chapter, I have practices that you can, and reflection questions that you can actually use it as a manual for your own self-development. So trust is the first one. The second one is humility. And I talk about confident humility. I'm doing a keynote next week for a group, and it's on leadership presence, and I'm going to be spending a lot of time talking about confident humility, because you need to be confident, but you do it from a place that doesn't come from hubris, right? So it's that blend of and that integration of being confident but also being humble that can really help you thrive in this world. You don't want to be a doormat, but you really, I'm sorry, my executive assistants are barking in the background. So
that's okay. I put my cat there because they bark less upstairs.
Yeah. So like, they're by the window and school's out. So kids are going home. So my apologies. So that's humility. The next one is resilience. And that I define as what does it take for us to bounce back quickly from challenges or defeats? And that includes self-care. That includes, setting boundaries that are appropriate for your life. It includes a lot of things that are about making sure you fill up your own well so you have something to give to others. If it's empty, it's not helpful. Right. So the old oxygen mask on the airplane thing, you got to put yours on first.
Right.
So resilience. The next one is inner direction. So it's really learning to trust your own inner compass and your intuition and to begin to follow that more closely. So I'm at I, inner direction, vision. Do you have some clarity about where you want to go? And why you want to go there. And that's really important, and to continue to take steps. And I'll wind all this up in a minute about how do you apply this to the situation you talked about a minute ago. The next one is E, and it's expansiveness. So are you seeing the world through a soda straw? You know, because that's how we can look at the world. We can look at it just like this. Are you allowing yourself to really see it and all the possibilities and the range of possibilities that are there? When we're really stressed, we tend to go back to this. You know, we tend to see why things can't happen as opposed to why they can.
Right.
Right?
Right.
So that's all the reasons why things won't work. You know, that's where we tend to go. So are you thinking expansively? And the last one is responsibility. So are you living a life where you're the driver in your life or the passenger? Are you taking the reins to what you can control and trying to make a difference and influence things that you want to and need to? So if you're upset about the political situation, do you sit home and wring your hands and cry, or do you put your boots on and march? You know, that's the difference between those two things. So that's the Thriver model, and each chapter goes into much greater depth about my own personal story through that journey, as well as folks that I've coached over the last 25 years and their stories. How does it apply? Your other question. So I think we all have a call of some kind. That's how we're designed. And it's learning to listen to what is that call. And as I said earlier, it may be that your call is I want to be the best mom, and for the next 18 years, that's what I really need to focus on. So I'm going to work at this job that I'm not as crazy about, but I'm really going to be there 100% for my kids. And then I'm going to make a different choice when that's over. Mm-hmm. And some people choose that.
Mm-hmm.
It can also be what can you do every moment? So if you love people and you want to be a manager and you're not a manager yet, how can you mentor somebody new at work? You know, find the opportunities to express your gifts and talents wherever you are, whatever your role is. And don't be so attached to what the labels look like. And then you'll find a lot more satisfaction where you are. I think way too many of us, including myself sometimes, we keep looking for the island. It's like, if I can just get to that island, then everything's going to be okay. And it's not. You get to the island and it's like, oh, look at that island. That one's even better. Or look at that island. That one's even better. And so it's learning how to enjoy the swim while you're on your way, right?
Right, right.
So that's some of the advice that I would offer people, is to really look at where can you live into your dreams, your hopes, your wishes, your aspirations, and whatever it is you're doing right now, express it more. If you're an artist, then you find an hour a day after the kids go to bed to paint. Or, you know, whatever it is that you have to do for you. Or a writer. I have a friend. I think he's on his 15th or 16th book now. He's just about 50 years old. And he, every morning from 5:30 to 7, he writes. Every single day of the week. He's got that kind of discipline. And he cranks them out.
Yeah.
You know, so find your rhythm. Find what you need to do.
Yes, yes.
And integrate it with whatever your life might look like today.
Right.
You're still an artist.
Right.
Right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's true. And even with myself, I'm a writer and I'm an artist, but I have a business to run. So I can't dedicate every hour of the day to art. So I have shared how, in other interviews, how I get up I set my alarm for 4.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm pretty good at getting up. There are some days where I do hit snooze, but then I'll get up at 5.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that I can write before my day starts.
Right.
And then
it's about balance. And how do you balance those things?
Yes.
And really tuning in, being able to tune into your own system. To know, you mentioned your teacher who takes, you know, a week off a month. We have a little place we go to, we share with 7 other couples, and we go up 1 week a month, 1 week every 2 months. In the woods. And I love that time. And it's like, nobody gets that time. That is my time.
Right.
You know? And then I try to make sure that we call them sacred Sundays. The Sundays don't get worked on during, you know, you don't do work on Sunday.
Yeah.
You might have to do the laundry, you might do stuff like that, but you don't get to work on Sunday.
Yeah.
It's not always that way, but that's what we try to do. So it's finding those things that, and I'm on a news fast. You mentioned you don't have a TV. I do have a TV, and right. There was a while after the election, I was obsessed. I had it on 24/7. So I give myself now 1 hour a day, max. And I usually watch Rachel because I love her. But it's like, you know, I find 1 hour of either reading the news or watching the news or whatever. Other than that, no. And I'm so much happier.
Yes. It's a tricky one, staying with the news for a second, because we are... What was the statistics that I was given, told recently, but something that we see 250,000 messages a day.
Mm-hmm. I bet that's true, yeah.
In terms of the emails, the billboards, the headlines, etc. And it's one reason I don't have television is because I would be addicted to it. If I go into someone's house, like when I go back to England with my family and pretty much everyone has the TV on, I can't have a conversation. It doesn't matter if whatever's on the TV is just you know, not very good, I'll still get sucked in.
Yeah.
And I was interviewed a friend the other day. She's in England, and she just said, I don't do politics. She said, when I'm at my father's house, well, her parents' house, but her father's a professor, her mother's a doctor. So you're very well read, you know, very smart. But she said her dad just sits down for breakfast and he'll just go point by point what happened in the news, you know, this explosion here, there and everywhere. And the truth is that, well, I remember actually, I was having a fast from the news and I went to CIS and I got there and everyone's sitting around and then they start talking about what happened. They said, what do you, you know, with Paris and this is going on. And I just felt like a Luddite. And I just said, what happened in Paris? And they looked at me as if, where have you been? You know, and this was the big Paris attacks.
Right.
And I think it's very tricky because I really felt that as conscious, intelligent people, that we need to know what's going on in the world, especially, you know, in our own countries, but really around the world. We don't want to be isolationists and just know about our own country and about what's going on locally in your local politics, etc. But I think it actually comes back to thriving. Where is there this cutoff point that we can only take in so much?
And I think that we all have to, again, be responsible for ourselves and our lives about calibrating what we know we need. I know for me, I need to meditate every day.
Right.
And if I don't meditate every day, I'm not as nice a person as I want to be. So even if it means I have to get up really early because I have a busy day, I make sure I get that in. Even if it's only 10 minutes because that's all I can do, I make sure I'm quiet for that time. I have particular pieces of music that inspire me and that help me connect to my center and help me really be present. I'll play those on the way to work, you know, when I'm going to see a client. Or I'll play a book on tape that I want to, you know, on CD that I want to hear, audiobooks. So it's things like that are inspiring. What do you need to do every day to inspire yourself is really important. And we have way too many excuses for why we don't do it.
Oh, it's,
you know? And we have to get real. We have to get real honest about that with ourselves.
I think I was realizing, and I've yet to do this, but I actually want to do it. Where, you know, how I've heard with, say, someone is reacting to food and has definitely a food allergy and they can't figure it out. So you keep a food diary. I was thinking about, okay, there are X amount of hours in the day. I did do this for a little bit of actually writing down what I do with the day.
How you spend your time. Yeah, I recommend that a lot for coaching clients.
It's a great thing to do.
You know, usually what I find in coaching, and certainly in my own life, if there's a gap between your intention and your outcome, it's usually because of one of three things. Either you don't really have the commitment, right? Or you don't have the structure, the right structure in place. Or you don't have the competency. So if you can look and see which of those three are of the combination do I need to really focus on, you know, for me, I joined a gym, and I think I paid $3,000 or so. I can't remember. It was a ridiculous amount of money, and I think I went four times during that time. I hate going to the gym. I mean, it's like worse for me than going to the dentist. You know, please don't let me go to the gym. But I didn't mind exercising. So one day the light bulb went off and I had this bright idea. Hey, we have this basement. What if we, instead of paying all this money, what if we bought a couple of pieces of equipment, put in the basement? And then I started working out two or three times a week. It was there. It was handy. I didn't have to be there sweating in front of a bunch of people I didn't know. So I found the right structure. So often it's just, what's the structure you need that's going to help? And doing things like keeping a daily log of how you're spending your time is very helpful in helping you figure out what the structure needs to be, where it's missing.
It really is helpful. I have a schedule book, and it's different to the usual business, you know, planning schedulers, day planners. And it, on some of the pages, not every page, but it details the important things to do in life. Did you meditate? Did you pray? Did you, what's your self-care? Did you make a meal? Did you eat a healthy meal? And I think it's so important, especially when you're running businesses and you're working hard and you're very focused, because those are the things that tend to be missed. So I was actually using it today when I was sitting with my project manager. So we could go into the business page in the planner and do the project. And then I opened the page and go and looked and said, oh, and I have to remember to do this and to do that. And so, so important. And I was just actually listening to a coaching call. And the one person was talking about interviewing this very successful businessman. I think he's a billionaire. And he apparently goes to the gym. He's at the gym at 5:15 every day. Mm-hmm. He hates the gym. Mm-hmm. He just absolutely hates the gym, but he goes. Mm-hmm. And what you spoke to is what's really important of how do we make something work for us. So, for example, I do go to the gym, and I don't do anything that I don't like at the gym. Mm-hmm. And what I like to do is I'm a swimmer.
Yeah, I'm a swimmer too. Yeah.
Yeah. So great. I probably pay too much money to go to the gym where I go because I love the swimming pool because they don't use tons of chlorine. They do the, what do they do? That oxygen.
But oh, yeah. It's they do a reverse osmosis thing. Yeah.
Exactly. Because yeah. I have asthma, so I react to a normal chlorinated pool. So I found what works for me. I'll go and swim at my gym. And it's my meditation. I found what works for me that if I actually start writing at 4 in the morning, it's my most creative time. Mm-hmm. I also realized because I've taken a break from running a business, but I was in school, so I was still working, but I forgot that I'm actually a workaholic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, again, that's why I really want to read your book, because I do not want to get burnt out, because it's not going to help me and it's not going to help anybody else.
Right. I feel the same way. I mean, I really, this year, I made some big changes in my business, in my life. And I cut back some because it was just like I'm not able to be for my clients who I need to be if I'm this wrung out and this tired. And I've pushed my next book off a little bit so I could just get a rhythm back. And now I'm working on that again. And it's like, now there's trade-offs. I had a wonderful friend who's an astrologer one time who told me, and I wrote this in my book because I've never forgotten it. At what price freedom? At what price responsibility? And we're constantly having to weigh that and make the decisions around, you know, where we're going to fall on that spectrum. And it life is really, at least from my perspective, it's a very delicate dance. And we have to make sure that we're pirouetting when we need to pirouette, you know, and that we're tender enough with ourselves and with each other, and forgiving enough of ourselves and of each other to allow what we need to be able to thrive.
Yes. Thank you for saying forgiving. I wasn't looking for something specifically, but I looked in one of my bags that I've been using recently. And I looked in the bag, and it was just a mess. Mm-hmm. You know, like I'd been throwing everything in there. It was a tote bag. My daughter even looked at me, and she was like, Mom, you have all these really nice bags. Why are you using that tote bag? And I said, well, it's a good question, but I can get everything else in there. And I looked at it and I just thought, oh my gosh, I need to clean out this bag. And I realized that I was sort of being critical of myself, mm-hmm. of what is wrong with me? Why do I have this really messy bag? Because I actually like to be quite organized, because I think it's true what they say. I think Stephanie said to me yesterday that they've proved that sort of organized people are happier. Mm-hmm. You know, or I would say it probably eases some stress for you when you
know. Oh, it absolutely does, because I'm not an organized person.
Right.
I'm not at all. It's just not in my DNA, and I struggle with it. And I spend way too much time looking for stuff because I'm not organized, right? I wish I was more organized, but I'm trying to be better. Now I have somebody who kind of brings a shovel in and helps me like every 6 or 8 weeks pick up my office, you know, so that's helpful. But, you know, you get the help you need.
Exactly.
But I think it's one of the things I talk about in the book, which I think is really important, is I call it that we have an inner critic and we have an inner champion. And most of us, especially if you've looked at, you know, a lot of the research on neuroplasticity, we are like sponges for negativity and Teflon for positivity. You know, Rick Hansen has a great book out where he talks about that Buddhist brain.
Uh-huh.
And so we have to focus, I think it's a 6-to-1 ratio, 6 times harder on holding on to the positive than the negative. So learning how to tame and calm the voice of the inner critic is really important. I talk a lot about that and how to do that. And then how to build and amplify the voice of the inner champion, who really sees you at your best, who really gets who you really are, who really sees your potential and your possibility. That's the place where we thrive from, yeah. Not this, right?
Exactly.
So learning how to balance that. I call it the angel on one shoulder and the devil on the other.
You know, right.
How do you manage it?
It's so true. How do you balance and manage and just how, and I heard you address some of this in previous interviews, and you know, I was so impressed how Jack Canfield, you know, the world's leading coach, but he interviewed you, and that's incredibly impressive. And for people who don't know, he wrote Chicken Soup for the Soul, and then it just went on from there, and he does some great work. But how do you sort of move through the world? It's one of these dilemmas, in a sense, that we are told it's not okay to have an ego. It's not okay to be successful. And you addressed that at the beginning of the interview. And so we're given all these mixed messages all the time of, yes, you're meant to be successful, but having money is good, and yet it's frowned upon, or you can't be wealthy, materially wealthy, and be spiritual. So how, I think at the end of the day, it's really making peace with our individual selves.
Yes, I agree. And I think one of the most challenging situations we have in the world right now is this proclivity for polarization. And, you know, it doesn't matter what the polls are, you know, good, bad, right, wrong. But the truth is, most things in life are somewhere on that continuum. And they move on the continuum, depending on where you are and what you're doing and how you're feeling in a particular moment. And I think that we live in a culture that's built on a lot of trances. And we have to break free of the cultural trances, I think it's plural, to which we have been enslaved for our whole life. And when you work on yourself, it is an inside job.
Right.
And when you work on yourself and you develop comfort and peace and grace and compassion for yourself, then a lot of those false polarities can start to fall away.
Yes. Yes. I agree. And I agree, and I'm saying yes because it's really been a spiritual practice for me. A couple of years ago, my relationship just fell apart, and it fell apart with a huge betrayal from my partner. Mm-hmm. And when you were talking about trust, how do you trust again when there's been betrayals? Mm-hmm. And really the only thing that I could do was really come back to faith, mm-hmm. in terms of really having faith be more a part of my day, mm-hmm. and praying. You know, I'd like to say that I meditate, but my meditation really comes more in my form of prayer. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And to make it a spiritual practice for being grateful, as we were talking about earlier, mm-hmm. and also not to be self-critical. And I was reading in a book how critical we are of ourselves, you know, we especially women, but I think people don't know how much men do it too. Mm-hmm. And also, I don't want to just be into two forms of gender. So however non-binary you, so say how we describe ourselves, but how we can attack ourselves, you know, like, oh, I don't look good enough, and I've got this extra wrinkle today, and I've got this, that, and the other. And how mean we can be to ourselves. And the book pointed out we would never talk to our best friend like that. Yeah. We would never say someone like, you wouldn't say to them, oh my gosh, you look so ugly today. Or
your child.
Or your child.
I think that's one of the things that I talk about in my book is treat yourself no different than you would your child.
Right.
Now, you wouldn't say those horrible, if you're a good parent, you're not going to demean your kids. You may correct them here and now. You need to do that, but you don't demean them.
Right.
And we're so cruel to ourselves. And when you can break free of that, and so much of this, though, I think, is just a lack of awareness that we're even doing it, right? So it's becoming more and more conscious when it starts to, I call it, in my book, I refer to the inner critic as like Muzak in a doctor's office. You know, it's obnoxious music.
Right.
Music plays the same tune, whatever your particular tune is, over and over and over. And then you just take it for granted that it's there, even though you could just go over and turn it off.
Yes.
And not have to listen to it. But you have to be aware.
Yes. Absolutely. You have to be aware. And I think until my attention was, I became attentive to it, I didn't even know that I was doing it.
Yeah.
So yesterday or this morning, whenever it was, I think it was this morning, I actually was attentive to looking at my bag, seeing this mess, going, oh my gosh, how did I let this mess in my bag get there? And, oh, this is where that pair of socks went. And this is where my favorite pen. And just saying, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. You've pulled together this great project. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doing this, you're doing that. And I don't have a partner, you know, like a romantic partner to help, mm-hmm. with taking out the trash and doing, mm-hmm. cooking dinner or whatever. And it's like, I don't have to be hard on myself. I can just, mm-hmm. say, you know, actually, you're doing great. And although some people might find it cheesy, but I have a chalkboard in my kitchen, and I was writing, you know, a list of, okay, I need to go out and buy butter and milk and all those other things. And one day I just wiped it all off. And I just drew a big heart, and I still have it there.
That's nice.
And I just wrote, I am loved. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I always write the O's in love as a heart.
Yeah.
I think it's so important to remember that even if we don't have one romantic person in our life, that we are loved. There are people in our lives that really love us. And so when we get to that place of, anyway, it can be hard in this life, that there's so many challenges thrown at us, that if we can just sit down at least once in a day and remember how loved we are.
Yes, absolutely. And keep things front and center and top of mind. And that's the thing that I decided with the book is I do a series called Monday Tips to Thrive that I offer people that sign up on my list. And so every other Monday, they get tips for how to thrive to focus on for the next 2 weeks. And it's really a practice.
Right.
It's all about how do we constantly work to enhance and increase our self-awareness.
I'm making a note, Monday Tips to Thrive, because I want to sign up for that.
Okay, that'd be great.
That would be, because we really do need reminders. And on that note, we've been talking for an hour.
Mm-hmm. And it's really fun. Thank you.
It's been really fun. Thank you so much. And we have mentioned your book, but if you do have a copy at hand,
hold it up.
Excellent. Great. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Thank you. What's the sticker? I didn't see the sticker on it on your website.
It says Indie Excellence Book Awards.
Excellent.
So
great. And then we will have a link to your website so that people...
Wonderful.
Our
wonderful.
Audience...
And I'm happy to put the list up for the... to sign up for the Monday tips as well.
Oh, that...
Anybody wants those, those will come out every 2 weeks. I go seclude myself and I write about 3 months worth.
Uh-huh. And
I put them up, so... Yeah, and I'm also going to be starting a Thriver's Edge Facebook virtual community soon.
Oh, great!
It's a place for people to come and talk about thriving, what's challenging, what's hard, what's working, what's not. And I have a series of videos that will also be populating that as well.
Excellent, excellent! Really great resources for people, and it's what we need in the world today, because we've talked about. There are the challenges, you know, there will be viewers who are working, you know, having juggling 3 jobs and children and all of that. Just juggling 1 job and children is a lot. And just even if you're doing life on your own, you know, there's a lot to do. So whatever resources that we can have,
yes,
helps us to thrive.
It does. And as a parting comment, I would say, the two biggest things I would say about thriving are focus on the love in your life and focus on the light.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Thank you. On that note, I want to say thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you. It's been wonderful.
It's been really lovely to talk to you. And I will be doing more interviews for more different projects in the future. So I'd love to jump back in from when we finished to just continue the conversation. Great.
Wonderful. Okay. Take care. Thank you. Bye.
Bye, Donna. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Keep calm and thrive on.
Thank you. I love that.
Okay.
I love that. Bye. Bye. Bye.